Crusade. We are back with episode 525 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, Mysterious Island, polite, creepy leader, time jumps. I know which new series Gary's going to love.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and if this is where the show's going, I'm getting off right now. I will see you guys later.
And this is Brunson from Australia, and... Really? Would it kill you to have some clocking?
Oh, boy. Let's just say that we obviously need to put the focus in the right place. And, for all that Fox is really poking the angry genre bear these days, the CW is probably going to be really happy this week. But before we go any further than that, let's go ahead and jump into a disclaimer so that we can get on with business.
Certainly. Our policy here is to talk about just about anything that might have happened in all of these wonderful episodes that we finally got to see this week, and so therefore you will be horribly spoiled, but we try and give you a little bit of time to catch up before we do that to you.
Yeah, did I say that the CW was going to be happy? I think it's just going to be DC Television Division is going to be really happy this week, at least with us, because we're going to be talking about the top three shows of the week on our list. And we have how many shows on the list? We have, well, it's 17 episodes, but 16 shows. So out of that, we have the top three. And if we have time, we are going to also get into the bottom three. And amazingly enough, Fox not showing up at all on this list. Huh. Well, that's okay, because they gave us plenty of hope for the future that they'll show up towards the bottom of our list any day now. But anyway, let's go ahead and, as we were trying to say before, move on to perhaps happier moments. And the... number three show of the week, and that would happen to be Arrow. So let's go ahead and run a promo.
It's Ra's custom to leave behind the instrument of death as a memorial to honor the fallen. Oliver Queen is dead.
They think they own this town. They think they own us. Tonight we show them otherwise.
Together, we are going to take over the Glades.
This is everything Oliver was working for.
There is no this without him.
Are all my hands too tight around your neck?
I don't know what happens next.
Please, Oliver, where are you?
It's him!
Returns with an all-new episode this Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on the CW.
And let's see, Bronstone, why don't you do the recap for us?
I can probably swing that. Okay, so Arrow, Season 3, Episode 10, Left Behind. And no Kirk Cameron to be seen, thankfully. The team try to protect the city in the Arrow's absence and fear the worst may have befallen their friend. But Felicity refuses to believe Oliver could be dead until Merlin pays the team a surprise visit. Meanwhile, Ray tests a part of his new suit, and Laurel takes up the mantle of the Black Canary.
Yes, and this had an average score of 8.25, so good amount above average. And it looks like, yeah, obviously we all liked this episode quite a bit. This was the episode that had the most scores from our Critical Myth crew, a total of 6 scores, and all of them obviously were 8 or above. So Gary, assuming that you didn't run too far away... with the fear that we would be referring to a particularly different show. What were your thoughts on this episode of Arrow? I know that you are a kind of sporadic watcher.
Is it safe to come back? Anyway.
It is.
Okay. I really liked it. I liked this sort of what happens to the rest of the supporting cast when the main guy is gone. And quite frankly, it seems like they stepped up just fine and dandy. They, they're out active and, their teamwork's still intact, and they're trying to make things happen. I liked it. Is it Diggle?
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. I enjoyed him taking the playing the faux Arrow role, and how it shows that the actual Arrow persona still strikes fear and stuff like that. I had some issues. It's obvious that you should think that he's dead at this point, that Oliver's dead. Yet the not even denial, but the sort of absence of the possibility that seem to go through, especially Felicity and even some of the other people. Like, they're waiting for him to show up, and they really shouldn't be. It sort of takes away from some of the impact of what we saw at the end of the mid-season break. So that sort of disappointed me, that they didn't sort of more deal with he's gone. I would have liked to seen a bit more of that, but, and perhaps we will, but it just seemed a little lighthearted in that aspect. Merlin's role, well, as you said, I'm a casual viewer of this show, so I don't know the character that well, but his sort of genuine interest in a positive manner seemed to take me off guard, that I didn't think he was quite that close with, you know, the rest of Team Arrow, that he would almost be an ally to some extent, but at least not the way I remember Arrow speaking to him. So it caught me a little off guard. The whole Ray Palmer plot lines continues to develop, and would they just spin him off to his own show already? It seems a bit superfluous in the likes of that. Also, you know, Laurel taking up Black Canary, you know, given that they need extra hands on deck with Oliver gone, made sense, and she seems like she'll do well in the role, so I'm looking forward to that. So overall, I sort of liked it. It was, like I said, it's what happens after the fact, and I thought it showed that things go on, and it's not always a disaster afterwards.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I really liked about this was that we finally got the flashbacks weaving into the story in a more meaningful context, and it really was incredibly meaningful. What did you guys think about that? How about you, Bronstone?
I was honestly surprised by some bits of that flashback thing. Not just the flashback thing, but the way that it did meld into the main story with certain characters who I had just assumed were dead or out of the story, and then wound up coming back as being the way in which we're going to bring Ollie back into the story. Gary, you mentioned that you thought that they should just spin Ray off into his own show already. See, here I think this is the time when you have Ray step up and become the because we haven't really seen him become his own hero yet, the way that he wants and the way that he's talking about. This is when he should be doing it. This is when he should be stepping up and showing us what he's got. When Oliver's not around, I mean, the city at large thinks that the Arrow is still about, but our heroes know, and that he's not. And Ray is probably in as good a position as anyone else to maybe realize the truth about what's going on with the Arrow right now. That that there's just play acting going on, and the real Arrow is not here anymore. And this is a really good. This storyline of Ollie, you know, coming back to life and getting his stuff together and coming back to Starling City, we've already got Laurel stepping up and becoming the Black Canary. I mean, this is where you have the Atom show up. This is where you have Arsenal become a lot more of a thing, and they're laying a lot of good groundwork for the idea of essentially Team Arrow evolving into something that is not as much of a team, but and more of an alliance, more of a society or a league, as you will.
Careful.
Yeah. Of
you don't say.
You don't say. Yeah, we've got all of these characters poised to step up and become heroes in their own right, and we've got the perfect reason for it, which is that the guy who has been Starling City's hero up to that point is not around anymore, and so I kind of hope they don't bring Ollie back for a little bit. I haven't seen the previews for the next episode or whatnot. I know he will come back, you know, come back to Starling City at some point, but I hope it's not for a while, so that we can not only get, you know, keep that vacuum open for all these new heroes to step up, but then when Ollie does come back, well, is Arsenal or Black Canary like going to be as willing to, you know, work for Ollie as opposed to with him? Like he would. I mean, I can definitely see a conflict like that. And then on top of that, you've got the Atom, who really has no, real relationship with the Arrow and stuff like that. Like, I can see them laying the groundwork for a lot of really, really good, really interesting stories that can take us through to the end of the season. That can really play on what we saw right from the beginning of season three. What do they call it? Coming back, I forget what the hell it was, but yeah, playing on this notion that we saw at the beginning of the season of we have, more heroes stepping up to defend Starling City in the wake of this of these bad things, and it's an interesting storyline. I was into the notion of let's explore more superhero dynamics, and yeah, I thought this did a good episode of this episode did a good job of furthering stories, setting up new stories, and just being really entertaining in its own right. And besides, who doesn't like Vinnie Jones showing up and talking tough?
Yeah.
He does do it well.
Yeah, Edmund, what would you add to all this?
I agree with all that. The one thing I was a little surprised at the speed with which they did resurrect Oliver, but at the same time, I thought they did a very good job of actually managing to juggle all of those different elements of the team trying to step up and trying to figure out what they were going to do in Oliver's absence, and getting the news and Laurel taking on the mantle of Black Canary. So it's certainly a case where by the end of the episode, and especially the way they teased about who was actually taking him off the mountain, since I know I had been speculating certainly that maybe it was Merlin himself, but the way they did in the end tie it so directly into the flashbacks really brought that whole storyline to a head, and as Bronstein was saying, I mean, even though they did wrap up the question of is Oliver dead this quickly, I do hope that they take a little bit of time for him to actually get back and explore how the team is operating in his absence, rather than him just showing up next episode and things going back to wouldn't be normal, but whatever the new normal is going to be.
Yeah, I get the sense that that's exactly the way that they're going here, and in fact, I think that it is the right way for them to approach it. This is what they've been building up to for the supporting cast, and so they need to be as thorough with it as they can. And I think that they are already on the right track with that, at least as far as I'm concerned. Like I said, this one coming in at the number three position, as far as the top three. Any last thoughts on Arrow this week, any of you?
No.
Okay. If not, then let's go ahead and move on to the second show. And this one's a bit of a surprise to me. Constantine comes back with a rip-roaring episode. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
On the next all-new Constantine, to save his own life,
he cast a demon into himself.
He'll risk damnation.
What if you can't get it out?
Kill me.
How long can he fight the darkness?
I won't be able to hold it back much longer.
When it comes from within.
John,
I will not be cast out.
I can't save him.
Constantine, Fridays after Grimm.
Gary, if you don't mind doing this recap.
Absolutely. We're talking about Constantine, Season 1, Episode 9, The Saints of Last Resorts, Part 2. John risks his life when, in order to fend off a vicious attack, he summons a demon to heal himself. At the same time, Chaz, Zed, and Anne-Marie race against time to save their friend from his possession.
Yeah, and this one came in at an average of, hold on for just one moment, 8.5. So that was a big surprise to me, for everybody, all of us, to really enjoy this episode as much as we did. Gary, you gave it a 9.
Yeah, I mean, when they said that there's going to be a Constantine show, this is what I expected, and they delivered it for me. So, I mean, I can't complain. There's some little tidbits here or there that were a touch off, but I have to give them credit for executing a great episode. Even if you want to let this one stand alone from the first part, which I don't think is hard to do. It had his manipulation of magic for his own ends, and that he finds out that it always seems to bite you a little bit. And he there was a price to pay for what he did, and he had had associates that were willing, for some reason that we don't quite understand why they love this guy so much, still stick their necks out and help him. And there was comedy with some of the situations when he was first possessed. Everybody would leave him alone in the prison. There was heartfelt things when you could tell he felt bad that he was that the demon within him was slaughtering these people. I mean, so you had humor to pathos, you had friendship, you had victory. So it just fired off very well for me.
Bronstein, how about you? What are your thoughts on this one?
I definitely enjoyed it, but I feel like not necessarily as much as you guys did. I feel like it's tough to do a storyline in which you basically take the hero and have them bedridden and shouting demonic nonsense for the majority of the episode, or at least half the episode. Like, there's don't know. I thought the first half was great. I loved what we learned about John, about Chaz, about these other characters. Having them be the team, like kind of like we were talking about with Arrow, the idea of the supporting characters having to step up and do the work of the hero while the hero is out of it. But they sort of get the hero back about halfway through, and then we just get, you know, the rest of the episode is trying to fix him when we kind of know already that they're going to fix him, and it just didn't have nearly as much suspense. It wasn't nearly as it didn't engage me as much as the first half of the episode did. If they'd maybe spent a little longer trying to get us to I don't know, if they sort of fuss with the ratio a little bit, like, you know, it took us longer to get Constantine, and therefore the whole exorcism would have been a shorter bit of the episode, I think I probably would have liked it more. That second half just kind of the pace, the tension, it all just sort of evaporated.
I guess for me, one of the reasons that I really liked this one was that it's all the reasons why I think the show is struggling to maintain an audience, or at least support from the network, is that this conceptually should not be an easy show. What I mean by that is that it's not an easy one to just throw out there and have people embrace. The subject matter is difficult. It's a comic book, perhaps a few steps removed, analog to kind of like the Hannibal idea, where it's like there's going to be people who really, really love it, and then there's going to be a whole lot of people that wonder why there's even a show about this, and just get kind of disgusted by it. Here, it would probably be more on religious grounds or just spiritual grounds than, you know, culinary grounds. But anyway, it's just a dark show. It's a difficult show to watch, and the things that make it so are the reasons that I actually like it. They're not doing what they did in the pilot, where it feels like they're playing to it. They're actually doing it, which is the difference. And I really feel like the Matt Ryan in the lead role has really embraced it. It took him a couple episodes, but now I completely buy him in the role, and he sells it very well. The supporting cast is selling it. Yes, we know he's going to get through it fine in the end. It's more, what is the cost going to be? And I don't know that we're even entirely clear on what that is just yet. But one thing that I found very interesting is that for a show that is really on the edge of being canceled after one season, the ratings are actually starting to tick back up now. And I'm thinking it's because that initial reaction of lack of authenticity has been addressed, and now people are kind of hearing good things about the show. It's not like it's getting huge ratings, but it's no longer sliding downward. It's gaining a little bit of ground. And I think that has everything to do with the fact that you can watch the show and tell that everybody is all in on this. And really, how many shows are going to have their main character possessed by a demon and killing people? Not too many.
No,
that's true. I do know what you mean about how the subject matter is going to turn people off and on, but I just think there's bits of the execution that could be better. That's what I do agree with you. I think the lead actor is just he's doing a fantastic job as Constantine, as the I think it was the first or second episode where they just sort of gave me the line that in my head kind of crystallized what kind of guy John Constantine is going to be. It's like the blue collar warlock. He's got that sense of, like, you know, despite all the, you know, he has all the mysticism, all the occult knowledge and stuff like that, but it's just kind of simmering under this layer of very blunt working man, I don't give a toss kind of attitude and stuff like that. And he's doing a fantastic job with it. Also, if I'm ever watching the show and Chaz speaks and I'm not looking at the screen for whatever reason, I could swear it's Clancy Brown. This has been bugging me for like the whole show. Am I the only one who thinks this? Like, it's such a good sound alike.
I hadn't until you mentioned it, but I do now.
Yeah, now we're never going to be able to watch the show. Great, thanks. No, anyway.
No. This is good. They found young Clancy Brown to play Chaz.
There you go.
Great. Put him and Clancy Brown in an episode. It's going to be like a base off. To beat poetry or something. It'll be amazing.
Edwin, what can you add to all this?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, certainly, I mean, I do see what Bronson's saying about some of the pacing, but to my mind, I mean, actually, but just the fact they were willing to go that far with the exorcism, I give them points for, and all of the earlier stuff. I mean, certainly they were playing on all of the Mexican prison cliches. I mean, I think when Zed was posing as the hooker, I mean, I think that's almost lifted verbatim from that Charles Bronson breakout movie from the 70s, which I think was deliberate. So I did enjoy that, and the one thing I've been wondering about though is this whole scheduling change, and I've just got my fingers crossed that putting it in front of Grimm rather than behind Grimm will actually work. I mean, them having it lead off Friday nights, it would seem to be a natural to keep the Grimm viewers, but maybe it's a case of people who are expecting to watch Grimm and they turn on NBC at 8 and realize, oh, it's this other thing. Oh, okay, maybe I'll watch this. So I hope it works out for them. But yeah, as we have talked about in previous weeks, the tea leaves are not necessarily looking good. But let's just hope it's not another of those cases of great. It was just getting good, and then they cut it loose.
Mm. Okay, let's see here. All right, I think that we've had enough on that show, so let's go ahead and move on to our number one show for the week. And like I said, DC Television kind of bringing it this week, and this is not a surprise to me either. The Flash comes in at the very top of the list, and here's the promo.
I heard you pretty fast.
Come out, wherever you are, Flash.
This ain't no time for loving.
Robbery at the convenience store on Wholesome.
Count on a date.
Or a little old lady getting robbed.
How do you know it's a little old lady?
It's always a little old lady.
Thank you, Flash.
If anything comes up, I will be here in...
A New York minute.
A GIF.
I'm doing just fine.
Captain Cold, the Reverse Flash.
Heat Wave.
Stop doing that.
I was thinking of calling myself Pied Piper.
Hey, I assign the nicknames around here. Although that one's not bad.
Guess I'm a lot faster than a speeding bullet.
I don't believe it.
Believe it.
Guys, which way?
Left.
Right.
Right.
Left.
Not too many men can keep up with me.
Barry Allen!
Wonder who he is.
You ask me, he's a hero.
Are you a cop or something?
Something.
Time to get up now.
All right, and Edmund, if you don't mind doing the recap.
Certainly. This is The Flash, Season 1. Scroll. Episode 10, Revenge of the Rogues. Captain Cold and his hot-headed partner, Heatwave, plot to steal a multi-million dollar painting and try to lure the Flash into a battle of fire and ice by kidnapping someone close to him. Meanwhile... Uh-huh. Barry asks Dr. Wells, Caitlin and Cisco to double his training effort so he's ready when the Reverse Flash returns, and Iris deals with the aftermath of Barry's confession.
Okay, and this came in at a whopping, as I click over here, come on now, I'm having my issues too, at an 8.7, so that is, of course, the top show of the week, and everything was between 8.5s and 9s, and Bronstum, you gave this a 9, which was your top score for the week.
Mm-hmm. It was just a hell of a lot of fun. Not in the least because I liked the short Prison Break reunion. I mean that those two actors played brothers in crime for 4 years and did a really, really good job because they had good chemistry of the kind that they need for this role. So putting them together just made, you know, on top of the nostalgia value for that show, just the fact that they played off really, really well together, even in some of the cheesier scenes. I liked what Barry's doing, how he's the ongoing I don't know how to describe it. He still wants to be the Flash, but at the same time he wants to get in shape and be better for when the Reverse Flash comes around. And the fact that they're really playing up the dramatic irony, the fact that we know who the Reverse Flash is, but no one else does. Even though we're basically getting the exact same like the Malcolm Mullen arc all over again, but they're doing a really, really good job with it. They've got some really, really good actors. I did love that scene towards the beginning. They're doing the training and. You can just see Wells like just subconsciously start to take a step off the wheelchair.
Mm.
was such a good moment. And yeah, the episode was just full of these good moments, these fun beats with the characters, with the action, stuff like that. Really, the only thing about it that I'd knock was that final fight with the whole notion of if you want to neutralize the two guns, you have to make them fire at each other, like get them to cross the streams. It's like, well, yeah, but you know, you could run up and punch them, like just once. They didn't set up I don't think they did a good enough job of setting up a fight that the Flash couldn't just win by running up and punching him. Like the last time we saw Captain Cold, he was just like, well, you could try and get me, or I could derail a train and you have to save everyone while I do my thing. And I don't think they did as good a job with coming up with something in this episode. But then again, at the end, we find out that, well, maybe the idea wasn't so much to beat the Flash as just to out him. So yeah, I do really hope that we see the rogues back in future episodes. And come on, like you've got to toss Clock King into the mix somewhere. how can you not? You're like, no, come on, he's already in the show, damn it.
Yes, the amazing thing to me is that you literally could sit back and say, if you like, if Michael Scofield had survived. This is the sequel, because this character had the kind of manic intelligence in masterminding that Scofield was supposed to be known for, and
yeah,
his brother was the brawn, and this was it was like the two characters were right back in but in a comic book world, and it was perfect. It was exactly
That was why Wentworth Miller was such a perfect choice when they were doing Captain Cold. I imagine it was a case of, okay, they're adapting the character, they're writing out what his thing is, that like he uses technology, he's a master planner, he's really bright, he's really smart, and Wentworth Miller comes in for an audition, and they just thought, oh, this is good, we didn't think of this. And then it comes to, okay, we're going to throw the rogue, so we're going to have him have a partner who's a hothead, and someone would just sort of, like one of the writers or the casting people would have just elbowed his man and said, I just had the best idea. No, go with me, this is going to be awesome.
I'm sure that's how it worked. Gary, what were your thoughts on this one?
Oh, well, to echo what Bronson thought, I thought the moment that stuck the most for this episode with me was Wells getting ready to step out of the chair to save Barry. that to me was more telling, I think, than just about anything else we had. I thought the crossing of the streams was really stupid as well. I still can't believe a man with Barry's speed could not just come behind them and just smack him in the head. and knock him out. The theatrics, I guess, so we can see the guns fire more, seem a little bit, you know, odd. Plus, Barry getting hit with both guns, I don't care how fast you are, that's got to hurt if you get frozen on one side and scorched on the other. No matter how fast you heal, it's got to hurt like anything. And he just seemed to shrug it off. It seemed a little bit much although I suppose you have to suspend some things dealing with the subject matter. That I liked. The scenes with... I'm not mixing episodes with Barry moving back in the house, I thought were really nice. It really shows what a sort of strong family unit that they have. And I think one of the things we like about this episode, we didn't really need much character exposition at this point. We've reached that level where everyone's pretty much established and introduced, and we sort of know what they're thinking and why they're thinking it, so they can push ahead and do story without having to double back and sort of explain or go into the motivations behind things. You know, at this point, we're able to run ahead and jump right into the story, as opposed to, you know, all this sort of little world building that had been going on up to this point.
Yeah, we don't necessarily we're done with the show where it's telling us about who the character, you know, it's about showing us who the characters are. Now it's about showing us how the characters are going to change, like how they're going to go from what we know to the result of what's happening.
Yes, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I think you made a good point there, Gary, that the writers had a lot of confidence in the audience just already knowing a lot of stuff and being able to play off of it, rather than have to retread a lot of that ground. And maybe that's Jeff Johns being one of the co-writers in this case. He does have a tendency to give the audience a lot of credit for already either knowing stuff or remembering stuff about the mythology of the characters. And in this case, I think it worked out pretty well. There was a very confident tone to the script. to your point. Edmund, what would you add to this?
I agree with just about everything that's been said, and but just one thing in particular, at the end, the whole thing of Harry moving in, I actually liked a show for once actually acknowledging and dealing with, having this secret identity and dashing in and out of your apartment at odd times could wind up being a little strange to the neighbors. So I thought they gave it a very good justification for why he would move back. And I'm also very glad that I was really thinking after he did that cleaning up that Iris was going to realize she'd forgotten something and come back in just to make things a little awkward. But I'm very happy they didn't go there.
No, I do like that they're Barry and Joe living together again. Just partly because Jesse Martin's a fantastic actor, and giving I love the dynamic between those two characters. I mean, one of my comments at the I think early on in the show when we were talking about it was that there is very much a kind of tale of two fathers, or even more like a tale of three fathers going on in the show. That Barry is really this at least Barry in this season, we're really seeing him grow as a result of the dynamic between the father figures in his life, his actual father who's in prison for a crime he didn't commit, his adoptive father, this police officer father to Iris who's been taking care of him, things like that, and now Dr. Wells, who is the only person who can sort of go toe-to-toe with him on about the science and the technology, and is really trying to make him a better Flash. And given the reveal of Dr. Wells and the Reverse Flash and all that, now we know that there's a lot more to that aspect of the storyline. Giving Joe a bit more prominence, I think, it's going to yield dividends for as far as the dramatic storytelling of the show going forward. Just the idea of Joe who wants to make Barry a better Barry, and Wells who wants to make Barry a better Flash.
Hmm. Yeah, because they've certainly been setting up that tension, and even in this episode, that whole bit about him, Wells implanting the having to set priorities line, and Joe picking up on it immediately. So yeah, that definitely seems to be one of the themes they want to bring out.
Anything else that we can say about this episode, guys?
Keep it up.
Yeah, right. Certainly very happy with both the Flash and the Arrow this season, and they seem to be really knocking it out of the park. All right, we're going to take a mid-show break here, and when we come back, we're going to have to delve into, unfortunately, the bottom three shows of the week. Stay tuned. And hey, if we have some shows that are really overperforming, shall we say, there's obviously going to be those ones struggling to keep up with the with the pace. And unfortunately, we have some shows here that are not strangers to the bottom of the list this season. Let's put it that way. Although I do feel it's an unfortunate in this first case. And this would be the season-ending two episodes of The Librarians. Let's start there. Here is the promo for at least the first one.
Fate has in store for us. We should meet it head on.
The Librarians' two-hour season finale will be legendary.
Guys! Company!
Every mission,
the monsters are rising,
has led.
History is falling apart.
To this.
I believe that I have found a way
to bring back the library. The Librarians, two-hour season finale, next Sunday at 8 on TNT. And watch anytime on demand.
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind doing the recap, and you can do both because I think it's all we're going to wind up talking about just how the show's season ended anyway.
Sure, no problem. We're talking about The Librarians, season 1, episodes 9 and 10, The Librarians in the City of Light. A missing person case leads to what could be an alien invasion in a small town. Then also The Librarians and the Loom of Fate. Duloc changes the course of fate, putting Baird through alternate timelines that show the Librarians transforming destinies as well as her own multiple dooms.
Yes, and episode 9 came in at a dead average 7, and the finale for the first season of The Librarians, episode 10, came in at a higher 7.63, which would have been a bit more in the middle ground of our week this time, but that first episode really was the one that kind of pulled them down into the bottom three. And Gary, I mean, even you felt like this was a bit of a weak entry.
Well, I suppose. I mean, I thought my the first one was a bit weak. And just as a side personal note, I have my dog is named Tesla, actually. So every time they said Tesla while we were watching this show, the dog would perk up and start to yelp. So we had an enjoyment factor that was unexpected in this episode, but quite humorous for me. No, I thought it was a reasonably fair episode. It was definitely, I think, for The Librarians, it was a better than average episode for the show itself. Again, this continues to be light fare, and some of the stretch to save the town seemed it seemed a bit unrealistic and didn't quite follow. It almost felt like they were making it up as they went along, which hadn't been the case for a lot of these episodes. So it struck me as weak writing. The general premise was good. It was just the execution of the problem being solved, I guess, that didn't seem to ring true for me. So I like the episode. I like this idea of the lamps being sort of this energy cage holding all these people together. I thought it was a novel idea for a concept to play with. The Librarians, I think, honestly, have consistently been coming up with, I don't want to say gadgets, because I don't want to say it's a gadget oriented show so much as gimmicks, these ideas upon which to base an episode, I think are still very creative, and I look forward to more of them. So as we talk about the next episode, we can go into that a bit. But of course, it's alternate dimension trapped. It's not an unheard of concept, but I thought they utilized it in a fun, interesting way. Did you guys think that the whole, a lamppost things was poor or badly executed? I thought it was a great idea.
I agree.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, this episode were really interesting. The idea of, bringing in Tesla, of what these lamps were designed to do, what these creatures were. Conceptually, it's really interesting. And I think had the episode been executed a little better, you would have presented the characters with a real kind of moral dilemma. They've got to figure out the quandary. I just think that it was the execution that was kind of flawed.
The story, I felt, was perfectly fine. It was, as you said, the execution that just made it very, very mediocre. It was slow. It didn't really flow very well. And the resolution, I just don't think they had the budget to pull off what they were trying to do. And it made it feel just lacking as a result, which, I mean, it's kind of odd to say that because, we do have examples of shows where they don't have a very high budget, but they managed to pull it off just fine. Here, it just felt like they, once again, had that whole exceeding, their grasp exceeded what they were able to achieve. But Gary, you gave the finale itself a pretty high mark, 8.5, so above average. So, what was it about the finale that you particularly liked?
Oh, I thought they did a wonderful job with the alternate librarians. It really felt like they grew distinctive personalities, that they weren't just the same character that we currently know that have assumed the librarianship. They, you know, all three of the characters really felt like they had fundamentally changed as a result of being the librarian, and that was nice. It sort of, as well as it showed for, I guess, the librarian, you know, they showed sort of what he was like before becoming that, and it showed everyone's change when they become the librarian, how it alters them. And I thought that was really well done, and I love the different scenarios, although I was a bit saddened that almost every other reality turned out not only to kill Baird, but also to sort of be doomsdays, as if, you know, they weren't like that. They, as librarians, were not actually able to solve the problems. That was a little disheartening to me. But I love the idea, you know, of the loom. I love the idea of Lancelot and Galahad.
The idea of hiring your husband to show up for one day of shooting to stab you.
Oh, that was an unexpected surprise as well. Yeah. And I had to tell my son that, no, this is not a Sliders episode. Anyway, and
there are times the budget makes me think so, but.
Yes, I can understand that, but at the same time, so it still was not. That show is over. There is no seventh season. Anyway, thankfully. That was a nice little surprise too. So I think I thought it was a very good episode. I ranked it pretty high. I think I myself gave it an 8.5 because I thought it was good. I mean, there's some slight room for improvement, but unlike some of our other board members, I thought this episode held together much better than the previous one and just was really good altogether. I mean, did you guys like the idea of this, the whole alternates and, you know, their different strengths and weaknesses, or at least how they sort of changed as they came out? That's what it rang for me in this episode.
There were good ideas.
Yeah, Bronson, you gave this one a 6, so that's certainly a very different opinion.
I feel like it had the exact same problem as the previous episode, that the idea of, like, there's good ideas, not the best execution. I did like the idea of, okay, the team librarian to become Nathan Drake, Dark Willow, and Quatermass. Thank you. I'm here all week. Try the veal.
I was partial to Dark Willow myself, but big surprise there.
Yeah, of course.
I told you, Cassandra, favorite part of the show. But anyway.
This episode kind of threw into sharp relief one of the biggest problems with librarians is the fact that they did not kill off Noah Wiley in the first episode. I think the fact that this franchise was Noah Wiley's from the beginning, that he's still an executive producer and stuff like that, I think a big part of why this show exists is so that he's got a job when Falling Skies ends. Is Falling Skies still on the air? Did that get picked up? Or
Last season.
One final season. And then he can be back to this full time, which I can tell you'll enjoy.
If he was going to be a full-time part of the show, he needed to be a full-time part of the show from the beginning.
Yes.
Instead, I think the comparison I made early on in the show's run was that this is like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. if the Avengers were Noah Wiley, which is not nearly as interesting. I dislike the idea, the fact that like we're introduced to this group of characters. I quite like the ensemble. I like that these individual characters. I like the way they come in as a team. I dislike the fact that every now and then Noah Wiley shows up to say, "Hey, I'm so much better at all of this than all of you," and then leaves again. It's like, okay, either the show needs to have Noah Wiley as an important part of the ensemble. He's the guy, you know, helping to teach these younger librarians. He's the one really pushing for this change in the way things are. Or he needed to not be around from the get-go. They needed to, in that first episode, when he gets stabbed by the sword, he needed to die. And the part of the arc of the show becomes, okay, these librarians have to figure out how to be librarians without a librarian to teach them. And the only teacher they've got is Jenkins, who really doesn't want any part of any of this. I think that the way that they're using him in the show is just not it's not helping. It's taking away from what could have been more impactful parts of the story. He continues to be sort of like the biggest question mark about the librarians, because I like so much of what the show does. I think that these two episodes have been some of the weakest. I did like the idea of sort of jumping around timelines and stuff like that. I think So, like, the concepts, the ideas were fun. I like the I wish the reveal of what's up with Duloc and Jenkins. I think that needed a bit more of a, like, it's, the reveal seems so throwaway that either they need to be, I got no sense that that they plan to give us any more of the storyline, and therefore I should be okay with the fact that we didn't get a lot of it. Like, I feel like this is always, it gave me the impression this is all we're going to learn of this big interesting thing about the universe. And it was just this throwaway thing.
Oh, I think that was done particularly because I think they had no confidence that they would, that the show was going to be picked up for a second series.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's part of it, and the fact that they aired so many episodes, you know, back to back.
Yeah.
Kind of was really good impression. Yeah. You can tell they're not too confident. That was not a good way to pass out that reveal. Even though it's an interesting reveal.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of liked the fact that they gave Larroquette's character an actual depth, even if they never explored it. I'm going to disagree on this point. Even though I liked this episode just fine conceptually, I agree with the fact that the execution was not as strong as it could have been. I think they needed more time to lead up to this idea of each of them becoming the librarian in another timeline and exploring the implications of that. We don't know these characters long enough, and that's partially because they doubled up on episodes and rushed to the end. I really feel like the character of Baird as the central character, so to speak, the Guardian, never came together for me. I think that the character is underwritten, and I think that Rebecca Romijn is miscast. She just does not deliver the character for me.
I think part of it is the fact that Noah Wiley's still in the show. I think you could have had a great
romance. Really doesn't help either.
Yes.
Well, no, it really doesn't help. It's not just that. It's the notion of the Guardian is essentially supposed to be the sidekick to the Librarian, and they're basically like, it's the show is like almost like a spin-off. It becomes a spin-off of a show that doesn't exist. Like, the we're going to take someone who is you know, functionally a sidekick and make them the that they hang around with to sort of be the head of their own thing. It's like it's the way that this universe, the way that this show, compared to what's come previously in this series, so that the way it's put together around the notion of you know, trying to keep Noah Wiley involved, it's sort of what shot them in the foot. I mean, the idea of her being a guardian, having a different function than these other characters, but being in charge when normally she's the character who's supposed to, in that relationship, who's supposed to be, you know, I'm a bit more passive's not the word, but secondary. That's an interesting dynamic. But the show doesn't quite play that up because she's still kind of supposed to be the guardian to Noah Wiley's librarian instead of the leader of this team by virtue of the fact that she's the one best able to lead a bunch of disparate people.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of potential here. I mean, then certainly going back to their previous project, Leverage, of where this season, I think to a certain extent, I can see the little seeds where they were trying to make this about the librarians coming together as a team that is greater than the sum of its parts, and actually, you know, and should have wound up being greater than the librarian himself. And if this had all been better plotted out and was really leading to that goal of, sure, he comes back and then realizes, no, you guys are not only doing fine without me, you're actually doing better. But certainly I think that was the intention of going to all the different timelines where there were parts missing and things haven't worked out as well as they should. But I did still enjoy what they were doing, because even given the jumping around and the bunching the episodes together, I felt like I was getting enough of a sense, but, you know, where I should say I wasn't getting enough of a sense, but what I was seeing, I liked. And certainly in terms of the comparison between the two episodes, in that first episode where there was, it felt like they were just taking all these references and just banging them together, where, no, it's kind of like a Twilight Zone episode, and, oh, Baird zaps out of existence with a transporter effect, and even a little music score that felt right out of the original series. And then we're going to have Tesla, and then it's going to be like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And but it never quite gelled. And with this one, I felt like that with the finale, there were references going on, or things that I was referencing in my head. I mean, particularly some of the better sections of Primeval, when they were going to some of those dystopian futures and things. But I think that it was part of the problem of, I think Bronze Thumb is right in terms of, you know, yes, it would have been great if Noah Wiley had just been killed off and they have to come together in his place, or this whole thing of realizing that now they are at least as he probably would never admit they're better, but they're at least as good as he has been. And and certainly the whole ending where, I mean, I know I'm one of the people on here who's always said, you know, no, it's, you know, I like the producers to acknowledge when they're not sure if they're coming back, but it was almost, there was everybody going off in different directions so that, we can, whatever happens, we can bring people back for a second series or do a movie or two or whatever they'll let us do was a little haphazard there.
Well, it sounds to me like, I mean, The Librarians was a show that as a kind of spiritual successor to the Warehouse 13 series, had potential, but I really feel like TNT needed to put a lot more money into it,
mm-hmm.
to give it a little bit more slickness, maybe pay a little more attention to the casting and just the conceptual side of it. Like you said, Bronze Thumb, this is the spinoff of a series of films that was, 10 years ago? So, it felt like a little bit of a miscue. It had some good points to it, though. I don't think that it's a complete loss, and I almost feel like I wouldn't mind seeing a second season out of this just to see if they could maybe correct the course, but I feel like the writing is already on the wall. But there we are. A series that is not in any danger of cancellation this year, yet is still struggling creatively, would be our number two, our second lowest scored episode of the week, and that is Supernatural. Here's the promo.
Full out, foaming at the mouth, maniac.
There's a Dean I love.
He's gone nuclear.
That's fantastic!
Supernatural, all new episodes return January 20th.
All right, and Bronze Thumb, if you don't mind doing the recap here.
I can probably swing that. Supernatural Season 10, Episode 10, The Hunter Games. Sam and Dean double their efforts to find a cure for the Mark of Cain after the massacre at the ranch. Meanwhile, Rowena plots against Crowley, and Castiel tries to mend his relationship with Claire, who is bent on revenge against Dean for killing her friend.
And this one came in at an average score of 6.83, and that is distressing, to say the least. I gave it the highest grade of a little above average. I would say that for me, the stuff with Dean and the Mark of Cain was perfectly fine. I enjoyed that part. I wish that was the episode itself. The subplot with Castiel and such didn't bother me nearly as much as it could have.
And then,
to me, then there was the thing that killed this episode dead in my mind, and that was Crowley and his incredibly annoying and terribly written mother.
Guess what? I did not like this.
Go ahead.
All right, sorry. I did not like this storyline when it was played out on Once Upon a Time with better actors.
Yeah. Edmund, you seem to agree with me that was the thing that really is hurting not just this episode, but this could be the albatross on the shoulders of this entire season.
Yeah, that's unfortunately what it's looking like. Crowley and the entire hell subplot is going to be weighed down with Rowena, unfortunately. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, it's kind of like what we were talking about with Sleepy Hollow back in when we were talking about the attempts to rejigger that. I mean, it does get to me when these shows have some wonderful actors and wonderful dynamics, and then you just throw a new character in there who just completely, there doesn't seem to be any need for it, and it's as you say, it's just sucking the life out of the show.
It really, to me, it's not even the character, it's the performance. The terrible accent, the character seems to be built around the idea, at least in terms of the way that it's being portrayed, of taking a character out of The Princess Bride and forcing it down the throat of Supernatural in the worst possible way. And it's just, it's, the show goes from being perfectly watchable and really actually good to being a nightmare the minute that she shows up on screen. And I hate to say that about any actress, but my God, who is thinking that this is a good idea and hasn't taken her aside and said, dial it back, way back, because you're so over the top, you're killing it. You're just destroying the show. Bronslam, you gave it a 6. I have to imagine that that was at the heart of your problem with this episode.
It was very much at the heart, although it wasn't helped by the fact that the Cassiel storyline I found kind of dull. I don't know where they're planning on taking either Cassiel or the daughter character. Yeah, really, the only thing that I did enjoy was the questions about, you know, Dean and the Mark of Cain, not just the question of how to cure it is kind of dull, because we've seen a metric buttload of exactly the same storyline over the course of the show. It's like, you know, oh, we need to, you know, assemble these, you know, three impossible things from these really impossible places and whatnot. I mean, it's like, it's, you know, putting Lucifer back in the box. It's, you know, the Metatron's supposed quest earlier. It's shutting the gates to hell. If they go through it, it's that storyline all over again. What's much more interesting is the question of Dean. Does he want the Mark of Cain, whether consciously or subconsciously? Does he want to keep it? Does he like having it? Does he want the I find that a lot more interesting. And episode that I really latched onto.
Well, I don't know that there's anything more to say about this one, No, I really don't. Edmund, do you have anything more to add to this?
Can't say that I do.
All right, well, then let's go ahead and turn our attention to the lowest scored episode of the week down at the very bottom. And I don't know that I'm surprised by this, but perhaps slightly disappointed. And that would be Helix. Here is the promo for the second season. And Edmund, if you don't mind doing the recap here.
Certainly. This is Helix, Season 2, Episode 1, San Jose. In the second season premiere, those who survive the horrors of Arctic biosystems attempt to move on with their lives. However, they find themselves unable to escape the long reach of the Ilaria Corporation as they battle a new deadly virus on a mysterious wooded island, inhabited by a cult that has no ties with the outside world.
Do, 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 do.
And this came in at an average of 6.5. So coming in below average, and in fact my grade of 7 was the highest, and I think I was being admittedly to the show.
Yeah, you're being very generous.
Oh, but yeah, geez.
Yeah.
Are they paying you on the side? What?
I only wish Ilaria was paying me on the side.
Yeah, I was going to say, wait, are those contact lenses? Are your eyes glowing?
Again, I wish. No. Especially since I believe that the price would be having to live in the world of Helix. And no, please no. Gary, you gave this a 6. And obviously this was the show that we were alluding to when we said that it was kind of reminding us of all the worst things that were said about another show set on an island.
Yes.
I'm not talking about the Arrow flashbacks here.
I really did not give it a low score because of that, although it would deserve it for solely that purpose. I was disappointed with the lack of, substantial previous characters' interactions. I wanted more of the characters carried over, and we didn't get them.
Or we did, but they're not even existing at the same time. So all that stuff they seem to be setting up at the end of the first season, it's like, you know, oh no, we're just going to allude to that in the background and then start this new storyline.
If you had any idea of the curses I muttered during that time jump, you'd be glad that I said them without recording. Anyway, it seems to lack cohesiveness. The thought that the 30-year gap exists between point A and point B is kind of depressing, and it makes you feel that the first half cannot possibly end well. So it feels like the whole – you already know where the story is going to completely go, and I'm just not looking forward to it. It's sort of the predestination, I guess, that while we didn't discuss it in this episode, the 12 Monkeys has to deal with is everything ends up poorly. Or at least in one version it does. So that's...
Yeah, at least that has the possibility of alternate timelines. I mean, I guess this one does too. But again, all that is just a symptom of the bigger problem that I have with this series and with this premiere. This feels like the writers taking just a very broad idea and throwing every little possible thing at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Again,
I can never see the main protagonist. I constantly refer to him as that guy from Wings. It has never
changed. This is a sequel to Wings. This is what that guy became. No.
He flew his plane off the harbor and landed here. Yes.
And crashed there. Yes, of course.
I like that idea. Yeah. And then started his own cult with him in charge. It really does follow very well. Thank you for pointing that out.
Whatever will make the show more enjoyable. The sad thing about it is that just like the first season, there is the DNA, no pun intended, of a better show in all of this.
Yeah, I'd like to see this from the Alaria side.
Yeah,
I think that would be a really fun show.
I just feel like this is everything that was Ron Moore's worst excesses up on the screen. I really do feel like I know you hate it when we harp on stuff like this, Gary, but I really feel like Ron Moore looked at Lost and said, that show looks like they made it up as they went along. Let me show you what happens when we make this up as we go along. And it already feels like 10 times more convoluted than anything that the writers of Lost could have come up with. The time jump, completely unnecessary. This feels like it doesn't follow on the tag at the end of the first season at all. And how many deadly pandemic viruses are we supposed to believe exist in this fictional universe that show basically the same symptoms, just a different color of the fluid that's coming out of your orifices? Come on.
Well, given the fact that this is a world where the CDC is this incompetent, I guess it does make somewhat of amount of sense that there are this many pandemic viruses.
There would be some who argue that this is a fairly accurate representation of the CDC. Look, these are the people who lost a lot of really bad things out of their lab not so long ago.
Yeah, that's John, going to Atlanta in a few months. His name is John, not Gary.
All right. But really, what else is there to say? Edmund, I mean, Gary already kind of gave his main points here. Certainly I did.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, the what you just mentioned about the Ron Moore writers' room that what we learned at the end of BSG or towards the end of BSG, it just really seems to be that happening again writ large. Unfortunately, without a compelling enough concept to start off with for them to muck around with. So and especially given that the lack of cohesion with the tag is what really annoyed me, because as you said, I mean, there was the potential there for some fun high tech conspiracy immortals trying to run the world stuff, and instead we're just stuck on an island, and this is a case where even I don't want to be there.
Well, I may be the one who winds up taking this one for the team. But we shall see how this progresses through the season. Right. I think that then we've covered the best shows of the week and the bottom shows of the week. And so next time we're going to go into, what our kind of, as I call them, the wild card picks are. And then maybe some other topics like that little news item from last show that is still lingering out there. And I think Gary definitely is going to want to delve into it. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.